Tragedy strikes yet again, and is yet again followed by the worst examples of our country's dominant religion, Christianity. Two public figures have already taken this opportunity to explain that we have violence in schools because we have, quote, kicked God out of the schools. That in other words, their most important concern in these days of mourning is to get their compulsory prayer bandwagon rolling again. I have to be careful where I wander on the internet these past couple days, because when I come across people talking about this being God's will or saying anything about God needing more angels, I'm in danger of posting something on other people's blogs that I will regret. There are ways we can prevent many of the violent deaths in our country. And church is a great place to discuss them and act on them. We will. My own list would have a lot to do with access to guns, access to mental health care, and the nurturing of a culture that does not romanticize violence and oppression. No doubt, other good ideas are right here in the minds in this hall. But the topic that was set for this Sunday months ago is also particularly relevant. It is about the core of Christianity. The religion that, although we do not by any means all share it, is very much the focus of our celebration here in December. You don't have to be Christian yourself to admire this ancient and beautiful religion and wish to learn from its wisdom. And that wisdom has a simple core. Above all else, before all else, shining out through all the accretions of 20 centuries is the central teaching of Jesus. Whatever we do, we should be motivated by love and act in love. This is not the message we usually get. Absolutely, it is said from many pulpits and lived out in many quiet lives, and we should be grateful for those and remember that they're there. I will lift up a few before I close. But in the most public expressions of this very public American religion, neither right nor left, fundamentalist nor liberal, Christian right evangelical nor leftist liberation theologian typically speaks as if the most important command to their soul, the imperative their God impressed upon them, was to live by love. The Christian right has narrowed its focus over the years to an almost single-minded obsession with salvation, particularly saving this individual soul. All of the usual expressions of love, such as care for one's family, drop by the wayside if they stand in the way of the determined march to personal reconciliation with Jesus. Just look at the high divorce rate among evangelicals who are required by their church often to choose between their church and the non-believers in their family. That the way to unity with God might be love is a possibility that this branch of Christianity has neglected. The Christian left has paralleled this development with a focus on saving others. The social gospel movement, the liberation theology movement, which are Christian trends dear to my own heart, admittedly get wrapped up in their own messages of service and justice that they lose sight of what lies at the core of them all. I am the first to quote Cornel West in reminding us that justice is what love looks like in public. But we can become so focused upon justice that we forget about the love part. Maybe we're embarrassed to talk about loving our neighbor, and it shows. Yet Jesus was asked, "What is the supreme commandment?" And he answered without hesitation, "Love your God with all your heart and soul and might, and your neighbor as yourself." Not fear God or obey God, but love God. Not serve your neighbor or save your neighbor or even help your neighbor, just love your neighbor. Well, it's no wonder that we shy away from that into other issues, because that is a tall order. What does that love even look like? Doesn't it incorporate saving and serving and helping? Of course it does. But since we are so prone to do all those things out of worse motivations than love, out of a desire to look good, to be righteous, to prove ourselves better than those other people, let's set them aside today and just ask, what might it look like when we are motivated by love? One group of people who sought to answer this question was Universalists who came before us. They, like all the people sitting in Calvinist congregations in the early decades of this country's founding, heard that most of us are headed for punishment. They heard it week after week. That all of us, are doomed to hell and deserve hell. There was a tension in religion that I think this doctrine was trying to address. A tension between love and justice. Will good be rewarded and evil punished? It sure doesn't look like it gets sorted out in this life. Instead, as Ecclesiastes says, the rain falls on the good and bad alike. The sun shines upon us all. I think maybe the reasonable outrage at this failure of justice led to the invention of hell, a place where things would be sorted out, where punishment would be meted out, and then those of us who deserve a reward can receive our reward. However, Universalists uninvented hell. They put love first. They believed that God loves us and would not condemn us to eternal punishment. And they believed that we should do what is right, not out of fear of punishment, but out of love. Unconditional love, such as one feels for a newborn baby. The love of God, the love of each other, Jesus' teaching right there in our Universalist ancestors. We are to live with the same love that in the Universalist formulation God feels for us, for all of us, the killer as well as his victims. Whoa. That needs a little exploration. Metaphorically speaking, does God greet Adam Lanza with the same loving embrace that awaits the children he murdered? Yes. Love embraces them all without reservation or distinction. And that voice in us that might be crying out now, I know it is in me. No, no. That voice, understandable though it might be, nearly universal though it might be, is not the voice of love. Jesus, after all, has a lot of authority on this question. He died young, too. He was murdered, too. And he knew he was being murdered. And among his last words were prayers that those who jeered at him while he went to his death might be forgiven. Words of love under almost unimaginable circumstances. The Universalist answer to that cry for justice, the wish for evil doing to be punished, is that actually hell does exist. It exists in this world, in the hearts of those who can't speak in the tender whispers of love, but only the angry shout of a gun. We make our own heaven and hell. And we make other people's too. But it's time to leave that tough nut and return to the possibly even tougher one. What must we do to live by love? Must we stop being angry? Confrontational? Must we swallow our disappointment and our judgment? Who can show us what Jesus meant? Why not Jesus himself? Ah, that's interesting. Jesus was not always sweet and patient, much less cheerful. He didn't match up very well with the cliche Christianity that we see in our culture, that kind of Hallmark card sweetness. The soft-focused Jesus with the long, flowing, light brown locks and the ever-gentle expression, he's almost unrecognizable to anyone who spends some time reading the Gospels. The real Jesus, by which problematic term I mean, the Jesus who emerges from the complex and contradictory stories told by his many early biographers, that Jesus was not all sweetness and light. He was impatient with his poor disciples, who were so slow to understand his simplest teachings, who didn't get the message even when he put it into parables and stories. He punished a poor fig tree just because it didn't bear fruit out of season for his convenience. He lost his temper and threw tables around, in the temple of all places. This is the kind of person we can relate to. And I think he has a few things to teach us about love. We could have gotten a different figure. Christmas could have been celebrating someone less like the baby who would grow up to be this somewhat irascible teacher and more like Santa Claus. Well, Santa Claus only has to be cheery and generous one day of the year. The rest of us have to plug along 365 days, and we need an exemplar who lives in the real world, who's messy like our lives, who can get angry and dismissive and impatient and even rude at times. It might be easier for us to love Saint Francis with the birds lighting on his shoulders, or Mary, with her patient forbearance and almost complete lack of personality. It might be easier to see them as the exemplars of perfect love. But that's not who is at the center of this story. As Zoe says in the wonderful book by J.D. Salinger, Franny and Zoe, if God had wanted someone with St. Francis's consistently winning personality for the New Testament, he'd have picked him, you can be sure. As it was, he picked the best, the smartest, the most loving, the least sentimental, the most unimitative master he could possibly have picked. And he goes on to say that if that's not who we see in Jesus, then we're using prayers to Jesus as requests to live in an easy world where no one else is difficult or real. But the world is full of prickly people, downright mean people, even violent people. And oh boy, look at that. That's who we're supposed to love. That's who we are, sometimes ourselves. It's a good thing we have this prickly person to show us how. Jesus, I would like to go on record as saying, was no saint. And yet there he was, teaching love, living love, even in the midst of his cruel, slow death. So let us clear away some of the detritus of judgment and anger and self-righteousness and narrow political agendas that put themselves forward as the core of Christianity. Let us dismiss the gauzy, soft-focused saints. Let us move past the easy Jesus of Christmas, the sweet, cooing baby, and look ahead just a few years to when he grows into an occasionally angry young man. And see how in all his realness, in all his humanness, he showed us that we too could put love at the center of our lives, our flawed, irritable, selfish lives. Let us hear again the words that are the gem at the center of the Christian teaching. From Thomas Merton, the monk whose personal prayer was made into a lovely song. In all I do, may I act freely and simply, from the depths of my heart, moved by love, moved by love. From our own universalist forebear, Hosea Ballou. If we are not agreed in love, no other agreement can do us any good. But if we agree in love, then no other disagreement can do us harm. And most of all, from the man whose birth we celebrate this month, the simple, poor rabbi who taught wherever he went, the Jewish prophet who spoke in the long tradition of Jewish prophets, speaking in temper and in love to hold their people to the highest standard. The man who never intended to found a new religion. Let us remember his simple words, another three words: love one another. So may it be. Let us in gratitude take up and give the offering by which we support the work of this liberal religious tradition. If you are visiting us for the first time, please let the basket pass you by with a clear conscience.